Muskogee County Sheriff's deputies are increasing patrols around a gun shop and a shooting range in the small town of Oktaha tonight. They're watching over the business because the owners are getting death threats. This after they posted a sign proclaiming their business a Muslim-free establishment. Casey Roebuck has some new information from Oktaha.
This sign proclaiming the business to be a Muslim-free zone has incited controversy around the country. It's also brought threats to the family that owns the business. And that's why volunteers calling themselves patriots are protecting the store. Today, they met a fellow veteran of very different views, and he received a surprising welcome.
Outside Save Yourself Survival and Tactical Gear, armed patriots from around the state, even around the country, patrol the property. This after the owners received death threats after posting this sign. The patriots we spoke to asked that we not use their actual names. They say they are past military who felt compelled to protect the family who owns the business. They say for them, this isn't about religion, it's about protecting freedom of speech.
If you believe that you're being stripped of your rights, we would be there right next to them. Be there right next to them, fighting for their rights too, and fighting to protect them. Excuse me, sir. You're on private property right now. And
while we were talking with the patriots, Chris Martin from California arrived. Okay. He's a fellow veteran, and he is Muslim.
Something that I feel like I fought for.
He says the store's policy violates his rights.
Unfortunately, it can catch on, and I mean, it has caught on, and others are doing it, you know. I think that's unfortunate, you know, because this is already a law that's been established for, 200 years.
Martin was met with a listening ear from the patriots, who say they have great respect for anyone who has served our country.
We both serve with every color, every creed imaginable, and I love all of my brothers. I don't care what color you are. If you ate the same dirt I ate, I love you and I respect you for it.
The patriots tell me they will continue to guard this business and this family until they believe the threat is over. Reporting from Oktaha, Casey Roebuck, 2 News Works for You.
Well, once again, Muslim terrorists.
A terrorist
slaughtered innocent
Islamic extremists now control parts of the country.
Their brand of justice is brutal and deadly.
Newsflash, America. These Muslim extremists are alive and well. They are not dead. And their video is not gratuitous. And it certainly is not irrelevant. It is a warning.
Welcome to the Truth About Muslims podcast, the official podcast of the Zwemer Center for Muslim Studies, where we help to educate you beyond the media. Here are your hosts, Howard and Trevor.
All right, welcome to another episode of Truth About Muslims podcast. We're going to talk this week about a video that has gone a little bit viral. You just heard it there in the intro, and some of the things you can't see, so I'm going to have to describe them to you. Essentially, what happens is there is a local gun shop in, I believe it's Oklahoma, that declared itself a Muslim-free zone. In other words, Muslims not welcome. And they put up a sign. The owner said they then received a death threat, and so people from the community gather. I mean, they're wearing full-on bulletproof vests, look like they're ready for war. Many of them war veterans themselves.
Are they wearing uniforms?
No, but you know how, a lot of Velcro, I guess. I mean,
just a lot of Velcro.
And, okay. And they have full-on assault rifles and stuff.
Wow.
And they're protecting the owners of the store, according to them. Now, one part that's not in that sound clip was one of the guys accidentally, his weapon fell, and he actually shot himself. Now, the person who sent me this video, I said, man, I feel horrible because he's okay. I made sure he was okay. But a part of me was kind of thought it was a little bit humorous that he accidentally shot himself in the arm. But then I felt bad, and I wrote the guy back. I said, I felt, you know, kind of a little bit humorous, and then I felt guilty. And then he wrote me back and said, you're a better man than I am. Still laughing.
So one of the guys that came to guard the place shot himself.
He accidentally shot himself.
Wow, that's crazy.
So ironic, it's not even funny.
Yeah.
Well, so ironic, it kind of is funny. He's okay, but he accidentally shot himself.
Right.
The Velcro failed. The Velcro failed on the vest, and the gun fell out from his chest strap and shot himself. I believe it was in the arm. So, but he's fine. What that clip that you heard was actually an interview with a local newscaster interviewing some of the guys that were guarding the store. And as they're doing the interview, a Muslim pulls up with his wife in the hijab.
A Muslim veteran.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they put two and two together until they saw his hat, which was a veteran's hat, and he introduces himself as a veteran. Now, what I find very interesting was everything changed at that moment.
Yeah.
Why did everything change at that moment? Why all of a sudden is this guy having hands extended to him, you know, they're speaking about, you know, him in such a positive way.
Yeah, they did.
And even afterwards, there's another interview with this guy where they actually invite him to come shooting and hope that he'll join the club and these kinds of things.
So really?
So what happened?
I mean, he had skin on. You know, I think their ideas of what Muslims look like, you know, whether they admit it or not, came from the media and probably their experiences. You know, but it's the same thing. Like, I remember watching American Sniper or reading the book, and I remember where they would, you know, the soldiers would kind of live in this separation, you know, this mentality where there's Muslims on one end that are like their translators, and they love those guys and they're great and they would fight for those guys and care about those guys. But then on the other hand, they would call the Muslims, the radicals, savages, right? And so it was kind of like this really loose characterization of, you know, this is what Muslims are like, and it kind of falls apart in places, you know, whenever they meet real Muslims.
Yeah, so a very similar thing happened a long time ago. We have prison camps where we put Japanese Americans into prison camps because they're the enemy.
Right.
Well, we also have another type of prison camp that I don't know if a lot of folks are aware of, and that was we had Nazi prison camps where we would take and put Nazi soldiers that had been captured in war. So we have Nazi prison camps, and the accounts of those that were in Nazi prison camps in the United States were that they were treated very well.
Yeah, that's what I
heard
too.
In some ways, almost better than they were treated as being in the army in Germany.
Mm.
So this is phenomenal. This is a very interesting thing. You have Japanese American citizens being treated worse than you have prisoners of war being treated. And the question, of course, is why is that? And Howard, I think bottom line, the people that are working at this prison camp, they can identify with these Nazis. They look like them.
Right.
They have their own kids that those kids remind them of. Here's these young blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you know, young Nazi soldiers, and they were treated well. And the Japanese, even though they were citizens of our own country, were treated horribly.
Right, because there's less common ground.
Yeah, you look like the enemy.
You kind of have that with the Muslim guy that was the veteran that walks up to that store that you were just talking about. When they saw that he was a veteran, right, his service in the U.S. military trumped his different religious beliefs, even though that might be like, you know, something that causes them a lot of anger or issues or whatnot, but it trumped it. And that commonality was probably, and you know, of course, when he spoke, he didn't have an accent. He just talked like a normal guy, but he happened to be Muslim, right? And they're like, wow, this puts a new face on what Muslims are like, even though I'm not so sure if they would treat, you know, Muslims that were not as common as they were, like didn't serve in the military with them and didn't have an accent. I'm not sure if they would treat them any different. Who knows? You know, that's totally different. But I think the common ground thing, I think you're right. I think there's some common ground that's you can't get over. It's too big.
So I think it wasn't just that this Muslim guy had skin on. It was that he had the right kind of skin on, meaning he had military veteran skin on.
Yeah.
And that changed everything. Like you said, it trumped all of those other, I would call them allegiances or identifications. Some people would call them identity. You know,
yeah.
I have a military identity, or I have a Christian identity, or political identity, or religious identity. And we have all these identities, and we're all a little bit schizophrenic in that way. We have multiple identities. Maybe it's that we don't have multiple identities. We just have multiple allegiances or identifications. And we aren't supposed to necessarily put people into these boxes based on where you see them interacting in one moment and say, well, he must have a religious identity. He's Muslim, religious identity, so he should act like this.
Right.
That's how we typically study religions and people, cultural anthropology. A lot of times the old school models would start with sort of a core center of worldview, and then they would build their way outward, that ultimately at the core is the worldview. And then the next thing is, you know, that affects your beliefs, and then that affects your values, and then that affects your behaviors. And so what we get to observe is people's behaviors, and then we can make assumptions about their values.
Right, we go backwards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But here's the weird thing. Aren't behaviors extremely contextual? Like, let me give you an example. Are the behaviors of your youth group different when you're in the room? What do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Are your behaviors of your children different when you're in the room?
That goes without saying.
Are people's behaviors different relationally? You know, do they relate to some people differently than they relate to others?
Yeah, like when I was in jiu-jitsu, right? Or I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and a lot of these guys are just, you know, like real tough guys training to be fighters, you know, wanting to be on like Ultimate Fighter and those kind of things. And as soon as they find out that I'm a youth pastor or a pastor of any kind, they all of a sudden just, they change. They a lot of them even apologize for cussing because they're dropping, you know, like cuss words like left and right in their sentences, you know. They're making complete sentences out of cuss words, and I'm just like, you know, like it's not a problem. I'm not judging their cussing, you know, that's where they're at. And I'm like, okay. And then whenever they, you know, find out that I'm a pastor, they're like, oh, sorry about that. And then we talk a little bit more, and then they're like, yeah, I need to get back to church. I need to start going to church. That's immediately, it's probably because we live in the South, but yeah, as far as the difference in conversation, as soon as they hear I'm a pastor, you know, it's totally different.
So a good example would be I was at a dinner with a couple Muslim guys that I had had dinner with multiple times before. I knew virtually everyone in the room, I'd say fairly well, and I had never seen any one of these guys pray except on Friday at the mosque.
Huh.
And then all of a sudden the imam walks in, and one of the guys immediately is like, hey guys, we're about to pray, right? And everybody's like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And the mom's like, wow, you know, he was really impressed. I mean, it reminded me of a youth group, like as the youth pastor walks in, like, oh, we're just having our Bible study. Really, they're playing FIFA, right? You know, 2015 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So everything changed, and I thought, well, that was interesting. They elevated, well, of course, that's the imam, right?
Right.
Different group of guys, different house, different relationships. Everybody's different, and a couple of the guys are overlap, but most of it is different. And one guy walks in and says, hey, I'm getting ready to pray. Who's with me? And all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, of course. I was thinking the same thing. And everybody kind of gets up and everybody moves towards, you know, going for prayer.
Huh.
And so everybody's spirituality changed with this one guy in the room. Now, if I had only hung out with these guys one night and observed their behaviors, my assumption might have been, wow, really religious guys. I mean, right in the middle of the FIFA game, they just paused it for prayer, you know? But if I had hung out with them the next night, I would have noticed that they didn't pause for prayer at all.
Right.
And so you have to be really careful when you take this sort of fixed model of looking at people and saying, well, I'm going to look at their behaviors, and then I'm going to make assumptions about their beliefs, values, and their worldview, essentially.
Yeah.
Give them a sense of identity, who they are.
Right.
Hey, ladies. I'm from Truth About Muslims podcast. Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Okay. So we want you to read an ad for us. Can you do that? You'll be famous, like world famous. It'll be amazing.
CIU.
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 I'm Kevin Kakaisen.
Kevin.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Nice. You just
Luke Fane. Luke Fane.
Luke.
All right.
CIU educates people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ.
You want to read that again?
Yeah.
You're like, I'll be so embarrassed.
But there's even like bigger senses of this, right? In terms of governments, people in their countries, and in different contexts, right? Like for instance, I remember whenever I'd see people. Like at a baseball game, right? And the national anthem comes up, right? Or
especially after 9/11,
right? Or if you're like, let's appreciate the troops. Like, mm-hmm. I've seen troops come off airplanes, and then people start to applaud. You know, like in those moments, people become super patriots.
Yep.
You know, super patriotic. And then on the other, you know, days of the week, you know, it's they don't even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it is interesting in different contexts.
And I think spaces and relationships.
Tell me what you mean by spaces.
Well, I mean just in context, as in geographical.
You walk into a church or
exactly
the war museums or.
Classic example would be serving as a missionary, feeling very homesick.
Oh, yeah.
And all of a sudden, there is a band playing in the evening. It was the band that played the Charlie Brown. You're going to have to work in some music there or something with the Charlie Brown thing. They were a naval band.
Right, and they were playing Charlie Brown tunes?
Jazz band, and they were playing, and I knew they were a naval band, and all of a sudden, man, I was like the biggest jazz fan you'd ever seen in your life. I am excited. I've got tickets. I'm telling my wife, you know, we're going to go to this thing, and I don't like jazz.
Right.
But this was a naval band, and I missed home, and I am American. So I went, and man, I felt like the buttons on my shirt were about to pop off. I was so proud of being American at that moment because I felt alone and very insecure about who I was in this mission, you know, as a missionary. Right. And so having something, you suddenly, something that might be, you know, if that band were playing today, I wouldn't go.
Yeah, you'd just be like, I have other options.
Right.
Yeah.
But at that moment, it was like, wow, this is a moment for me to connect with a part of who I am.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I grew up in a military family, so we stood for the Pledge of Allegiance or the national anthem before every, you know, movie.
Right.
But the point is, when
before every movie,
I'm surprised you just kind of took that.
I did. Like, I just stopped. I'm like, before every movie.
Everybody that's ever seen a movie on a military base knows exactly what I'm talking about. Right. Everybody else is thinking they play the national anthem before the movie. Yes, they do.
Actually,
and you stand.
For a fun fact, Thailand does that too.
Are you serious?
Yeah, every movie theater in Thailand. You stand for the national anthem.
So why do we do that?
Why do we stand for the national anthem?
Why do we have kids pledge allegiance to the flag? Why do we have them in third grade go
to the
statehouse?
It's instilling identity.
Right, it's giving a sense of nationalism.
Right, ascribing identity. You know, because it's not naturally there until you start adding a lot of meaning. A lot of countries do that. They have this idea of, you know, like we need to instill value into our nation, our brand. You know, of course they wouldn't call it a brand, but... You know, and then it comes with these deep, moving, you know, images now, you know, like the flag flying, you know, when, you know, these bombs were going off or
people
World
doing
War
II, it in unison or, even.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember Hitler watching old footage of these Nazi troops marching, and just to watch them march in lockstep was insane, just to see that many. And then however many people, all the Nazi flags, you know, like if you were a Nazi at that time in Germany, I can't imagine you would not be proud.
Mm. There's an excellent film on that called The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, for those of you that like good movies that make you think about the life of a Nazi soldier, that just how it affected normal everyday people.
Right. It's like super identity. You know, and we talk about this a little bit with gangs, you know, with the clothes they wear or the colors they wear or the signs they have, just this deep sense of identity. So where are we going with this?
So I'm thoroughly convinced that we are too simplistic when we look at people, and particularly when we look at them and try to ascribe them sort of a sense of religious identity as a being that's who they are.
Hmm.
And we do that with a lot of things, don't we?
Yeah.
We tend to really box people in and sort of categorize them and say, this is who you are, this is your identity. And then we're not okay necessarily with people doing that to us. The minute somebody sort of boxes you in, let's say they say, well, he's a professor at a Bible college in South Carolina. Well, if they had only been to a particular Bible college a little north of here where it's a little bit different, they would make some assumptions about me that I probably wouldn't agree with.
Yeah.
They would make some assumptions about my theology. They'd make some assumptions about...
Yeah, theology. Christians have that a lot. They'll say like, oh, you know, I'm Catholic, but I'm Presbyterian, but I'm Baptist, but...
I'm Calvinist, but...
Right, because they don't want to be pigeonholed.
Right.
It's not necessarily that it's even bad. They just don't want to be pigeonholed. It's so interesting.
And we want to be the one who defines the terms.
Yeah.
Because what you mean in your head when I say Catholic may not be what I mean. And what you mean in your head when I say Christian may not be what I mean. A good example would be when we first moved into our neighborhood and my neighbor referred to me as her Christian neighbor. And I had heard her speak so negatively about Christians, I thought, whoa, wait a second. She's just sort of giving me that term that she's already filled with so much negative meaning. I don't know that I want to be fit into that box. So I kind of said, why do you call me that? I've heard what you've said about Christians. Is that really what you think about me? She said, no, you're different.
Huh.
Right? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But what's really interesting is that you're reshaping her view on Christians.
Trying to. Hoping.
Well, and think about the Muslim soldier. Reshaping, you know, like even if it's even in a little bit, you know, like at my church, we deal with racism and, you know, like, you know, if you know anything about me, I'm trying to be like super authentic, because, you know, a lot of my life and my story has been about faking it, you know, just, you know, like a lot of Asian cultures, you just try to look like everything's great. And I still struggle with that. My guys group, we talk about it and stuff like that. But in this area, we try to be authentic, and I try to lead my youth group in that way. So we talk about things like racism, you know, but the fact is, like, a lot of us have, you know, like, let's say a black friend, right? And then we make judgments in our mind about blacks, you know, other blacks. And then when we think about that black friend, we don't think of him in the same category. We're like, oh, that guy's different. So he's an anomaly. So he doesn't really belong to the blacks that, you know, the general black population that we know of or so all, you know, carry around in our mind. And that's really scary, because then our minds kind of make these little leaps. So we don't really change, right? We just have these people that are anomalies in our life. So we have a Muslim guy who's a veteran, right? Talks like an American, you know, all that stuff. But it doesn't affect our view on Muslims. It's crazy. And so I've been really challenging our youth and challenging even myself in these kind of ways we think. But this, I think you're right. I think it really brings this to light, this, the fact that our identities are so much more complex.
Yeah. I think we used to think identity is really that you're the same person no matter what, you know, same person in each context, same person in each relationship, same. And I think now we've kind of determined that that's really a little bit more psychotic than normal, that if you have no sort of shift in who you are and kind of how you relate to people, no matter where you are, that's not a good thing necessarily. That could be very broken part of your
you'd explained your it before, and you said something about they're psychologically disturbed.
Yeah.
Like, what does that look like? Because you had mentioned somebody, like, if in every situation, no matter what, they were exactly the same.
Just imagine, you may have encountered someone like that. I mean, they make films, they've made films about people like that, but typically they're psychotic. Hmm. Like, there's no nuance. There's no, they're the same person when they're with their wife as they are with their children, as they are with a stranger. I'm not the same person with a stranger as I am with my wife. My wife knows me in ways that no stranger will ever know me. That's a good thing.
Well, just your gentleness towards your mother, maybe, you know, like, that would be very different than your boss.
Yeah. And I mean, if I try to cradle Howard the way that I would one of my children, he'd probably feel uncomfortable.
Right. I would feel a little bit uncomfortable.
So the point of that, what I'm getting at, is that I like to think of it in the form of narrative. You know how much I like narrative. And I think we tend to look at Islam only through a sense of sort of a literary perspective. Like, hey, just tell me what the Quran says.
Right,
and that's
academically.
What it
was, right. And Islam 101 is kind
of
like that.
It's got some of
that. We have that danger, right? Mm-hmm. You could jump into that, but keep going.
But Kenneth Craig said something in one of his early books that he wrote, that when you want to enter Islam, it's better to enter into the mosque than to enter into the Quran.
Whoa.
And I really like that perspective, because you can enter into the Quran or reach for the dictionary. You know, he's saying don't reach for the dictionary. Go to the mosque. Meet a Muslim. That's where you're really going to begin to understand Islam and begin to understand even the Quran, as you meet Muslims and see what they think. And we've been harping on that for several shows. But the whole point is, when you isolate a Muslim from all of the other competing and maybe even complementary narratives in their life, you miss something. So, for instance, let's talk. We mentioned earlier something about Nazism. There's this one. I love narrative photos and narrative paintings, like Norman Rockwell. But there's a photo where everybody seems to be standing and saluting the Führer, right? Adolf Hitler, and everybody's got their hand outstretched.
Oh, right.
And there's this one dude that's sitting there with his arms crossed, just kind of with this face like, meh.
Yeah, not interested.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not sold.
You know, and it's this moment where you realize that there is a powerful public narrative going on that is drawing everybody in, and everybody's on board except for this one dude. It's so obvious that he's not in, because he's the only one that's not doing the salute.
Das deutsche Volk ist glücklich in dem Bewusstsein, dass die ewige Flucht der Erscheinungen nunmehr endgültig abgelöst wurde von einem ruhenden Volk.
Right.
And so we
There are thousands of people in this picture. And it's clear. I've seen this picture.
Thousands. We'll put a link in the, in the podcast notes to this picture so you guys can get a look at it. But the point is that you have multiple narratives going on. And so Nazism was a public narrative, even a cultural narrative that was going on in a particular time, in a particular place. And then it became a global narrative. It went outside of where it originally started.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I think of the multitude of different narratives, you have a family narrative. Howard, you have a family history. You
right.
have experiences with your own parents and even grandparents.
Right. Aunts, uncles,
sisters. Go into that one day. It's right. an interesting family tree. We both have very interesting family trees.
It's amazing that we're alive.
So then you also have cultural narratives. We each have cultural narratives that some of them are more confined into our own families, and then some of them are broadened out to a culture like Howard's a Korean American.
Right.
There's a cultural narrative there. We're both Americans. There's a cultural narrative there. We both live in the South now, cultural narrative.
Right.
And so the available narratives are only so many. Now, when you step out of a narrative that's available, that's culturally accepted, it's taboo. And so there are some narratives within the Muslim world that are sort of global. They transcend all of the different places in Islam, like one, conversion from Christianity, not acceptable. I've not yet found any particular context, time, or space where conversion outside of Islam would be an acceptable norm. But that's quickly changing because eventually they're going to have to deal with so many people leaving Islam.
Right.
You see what I mean? And it takes time. Another example of a cultural narrative that many of us could identify with right now is 20 years ago, saying that you were a homosexual would have been taboo.
Oh, right.
Nowadays, for some, it's still very taboo. For some, it's celebrated. And so, and then there's everybody in between. And so you have this change. Narratives aren't fixed. They're changing. They're always changing. And you have to look at that person in the midst of the current narratives and also the cultural narratives, the family narratives, the global narratives, and then the religious narratives. And so there's all of these narratives. And I think if you tried to isolate any one particular narrative or any one particular person, distinct from the narratives, you're going to be really overly simplistic in your explanation of who that person
is. It's going to steer you wrong.
All right, so this show wouldn't be possible without sponsors.
And at this point in the show is where if you want to partner with us, we would put your ad. So if you want to be a part of the show, you want to partner with us.
You like what we're doing.
You want to be on our team, what have you.
Bring this show to the world.
Then email us and let us know. So another good example, I've mentioned Norman Rockwell, the painting of Ruby Bridges. She's walking down the street. The U.S. Marshals are escorting her. The N-word is written on the wall. There's fruit being thrown. It's a powerful narrative, right?
Right.
You know what's happening at that moment. And if you were to try to understand black Christian theology at that moment, to ignore the public and cultural narratives that are happening, you would miss something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you'd miss a lot.
Yeah, and so when we look at Islam, we have to look at the current narratives that are going on globally, individually, within their own family, culturally. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and but that means that we would have to be real listeners. We'd have to know people and talk to them and find out their stories, which is, you know, what we kind of harp on. But I mean, even just thinking, because we were before we started this podcast, we were looking at this video about Afghani women. I mean, how times have changed so much where, you know, they were getting so much influence and power in the country as far as however many, there's like a good, you know, like 40% of doctors in Kabul were women, 50% of teachers and students were women, so on and so forth. Women could vote 6 years before Switzerland. And you kind of see, you know, like how much that has all shifted. But, you know, there's a lot, and Trevor and I were discussing it, there's a lot to that. You know, of course, communism. The battle with Russia, of course, and then, you know, the Mujahideen, right, and then the reverting back to fundamentalist Islam,
and having the Taliban take over Kabul, start beheading people in the soccer courts, most of the more progressive Muslims fleeing to Pakistan, going to cities like Peshawar.
Right.
But the thing is depending on when those statistics took place, things are changing so quickly, because one of the best bands that I like right now is actually a band out of Kabul, a band called Kabul Dreams. And these guys, this is a classic example, right? You would think that Kabul is, you could pretty much narrow it down. What is Kabul like? except you have these guys. One of them is from Uzbekistan, who was growing up in Kabul when the Taliban came and there was a coup. He fled back to Uzbekistan. His friend is Iranian, and so he speaks Dari, and he fled Kabul and went to Iran. Imagine how bad it is when you're fleeing Kabul to Iran.
Oh, my gosh.
And then the other guy is Pashto, and so he flees Kabul into Pakistan. Well, now they've all come back, right? Because of the U.S. invasion and the toppling of the Taliban, Kabul has more open. And so these guys have come back. They've formed their band, and they represent like this multiple sort of ethnicities in places where you think it's really similar. It's very simple. It's Kabul, so they're all like this, except for these three guys break that mold. And I think that mold is probably... it needs to be broken. It's too simple. So these guys come back, and now they're playing at South by Southwest, one of the largest music festivals in the United States. They're playing their music, singing in Uzbek, singing in Dari, singing in Pashto.
Oh, it's not in English?
Singing in English. They're a punk rock band. Yeah, and so they play their music, and I think what they do is they shatter all the paradigms that we oversimplify, because we could just say that Kabul is really a place where, you know, this, and this happens. Well, but it's also a place where there's some really cool movements happening. And so, granted, I don't know what the current statistics are in Kabul. I'm just saying that it's we tend to pigeonhole things and make them really too simple.
Right, and then we kind of miss out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we think about this, how it fits with the Islam 101, that's how we are going to look at Islam. We are going to take into consideration the gender, for instance. A Muslim woman is going to have a different experience than a Muslim man, more than likely.
Right.
We'll take into consideration the socioeconomics status of a group or a people or individual. We'll look at the age. We'll look at the cultural setting. We'll look at the political situation. I mean, it would be foolish to not consider the political situation going on in many of these Muslim countries when you're talking about Islam. You have to consider the political sort of climate.
Right.
And then in all of that, you have to consider that Islam does have this concept of the ummah, the community, the global community, and what's happening. What is the public narrative with the global community right now in the Muslim world?
Right. So as we're listening like to these, you know, podcasts, Islam 101, so basically what you're saying is we're going to stretch everyone's views on Muslims to the max, as ultimately, as much as we're able. You know what kind of comes to me is that, you remember when we were talking to Missionary Brady, and we were talking about Sudan?
Mm-hmm.
Even the black Muslims, you know, have a different experience than, you know, Muslims or Middle Eastern Muslims. And then you got Indonesian Muslims, you know, that are having a totally different experience. It's so hard just to say that Muslims are this or Muslims are that. And, you know, of course, that's what we do in the politics.
Right. The analogy that I'm trying to come up with an analogy that helps it make sense. And what I've got so far, you tell me if it works.
All right.
I've got an apple barrel with apples.
A barrel of apples?
Are you picturing a barrel of apples?
Right.
It is apple season.
Well, I've never seen an apple barrel.
Yeah. You know how they give you the little barrel thing and you fill it with apples? It's like a
but
imagine
a basket. That's a basket.
But imagine a big barrel.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost like a wood
barrel.
Yeah, like something they would make wine in or something, like a big wooden barrel.
Right.
Filled with apples. I'll draw a picture for you.
Yeah.
Imagine a big barrel of apples. So you have the individual apple. It's important to know the individual apple, his story. I would even say
go ahead.
It's important to know the individual apple.
Right.
It's important to even know. Did you know that you can't actually take the seed from an apple and grow that apple?
What?
If you took the seed out of what's your favorite apple? I like the Jonagolds, personally.
No. The Mutsu, man. The Mutsu are the best apples.
Isn't that the really hard, like...
No, that's Arkansas Black.
Okay.
Mutsu.
It hurt my teeth.
It's sour and sweet.
Okay, the next time you have a mutsu, you take the seed out and you plant it, I'm willing to bet you're not going to grow any mutsu apples.
What are you talking about? It's an
No, I'm telling you, this blows Johnny Appleseed out of the water. Like, this is the urban legend, right?
Okay, go ahead.
It's
what
true.
Apple grows from mutsu
Nobody
seed?
Nobody knows. It's going to grow some strain that you've probably never tasted or heard
Nuh-uh.
Of, and more than likely, it will be inedible. It will taste horrible.
No.
I'm telling you.
Why?
I don't know. It's just the way it is. And I think what it comes down to is that the DNA and the sort of the all of the code of the apple is carried into the seed, and it can pull. It changes, just like humans.
Yeah. So like their redhead gene, you know.
Yeah, your children aren't going to look the same every time. They're going to look different. Same thing happens with apples. And so do you know how they have a whole orchard of mutsu?
Yeah, that was my second question.
Yeah, they actually graft in the mutsu branch to a set of roots.
Wait, time out. So you're telling me there's some mystical mutsu tree with
Somebody.
All their branches missing?
No.
Every time they grow, they just chop one off and then graft it onto another orchard?
Any mutsu tree. You go get a mutsu tree right now and graft a branch of that one onto a new one.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
But originally, yes, there was a mystical mutsu tree. There was originally one.
The one.
So in that sense, you have to graft in. You can't just plant the seed. So this is why my analogy, I think, is going to work. Is
okay,
the complexity.
Now, you got me compelled. Keep going.
The complexity is you have to know the roots, and then you have to also know what's been grafted in. What's been grafted into that individual's life. Now, it gets
That's
even more.
Good.
Okay, so it goes a little further.
Okay.
Not just the individual apple, but also the apple surrounding it, because now it's sitting in a context with relationships. These apples are talking to each other. They grew up together. They
Wait. So the mutsu branch that's producing one apple or two apples or three apples?
This is a barrel of multiple apples.
So they're going to be hanging out. This mutsu branch on a tree is going to be hanging out with other apples from this tree.
You lost the barrel. The apple's been picked. It's sitting in a barrel.
Okay.
It came from a tree, though.
Yeah.
That has roots.
And different
things
apples.
That have been grafted in. And now it's sitting in a barrel with different apples. And it has a context. And it has relationships. And those relationships matter. So you have to know the individual apple. You have to know where the apple came from. You have to know the apples that it's sitting around. And then you have to know the barrel makers.
What?
Because it's sitting in a barrel. Okay. And there are barrel makers in the world.
What's a barrel maker?
The U.S. is a barrel maker.
So political nations.
Russia is a barrel maker. China is a barrel maker. Iran is now a barrel maker. I'm not talking about oil. I'm talking about there are
like powers.
There are powers in the world, imperialistic powers.
So it might not be necessarily your political nation state that you live in. It's other gigantic political nation states that have a lot of power and influence on the rest of the world, like globalization.
It could be
such.
A nation state, technology. These are things that are global. It could be ideas. It could be religions. Islam is a barrel maker. And so you have all of these barrel makers happening in the world. You have individual apples. You have other apples. And then you have the trees that they've all come from. And I think the disservice that we do to individual Muslims is we tend to look at either the barrel and assume something about the apple. We tend to look at the surrounding apples and assume something about the apple, or we look at the tree that it came from and assume something about the apple. And some of these assumptions might be right, but I fear that many of them are wrong, and that we should be a little bit more humble in how we approach people, because I think they're created in the image of God, and that there's something intrinsically human about all of us, and that's what we should be searching for. And I think we don't do that oftentimes when we start saying words like they.
Mm.
Did I lose you on the apple?
No, you didn't. That was really good. I think that a deeper revelation in my head is that it's these assumptions that keep us from making relationships.
Yeah, I don't want to make relationships with people I'm scared of.
But even then, like, if I assume something about you and we're friends, we never talk about that thing. Because I don't need to find anything else about it. I just assume that that's who you are. But then when I do find out something different, I'm like, wow, I thought I knew you, but there's something else, you know, deeper. Oh, this changes my perspective of you in a, you know, a better way, like in a deeper way.
Right.
But a lot of these assumptions, I think, can sometimes shut down communication.
Wow. And you know what happens when we assume.
Wow. All right, well, with that, I hope you guys are enjoying the Islam 101. We want to keep doing more and more. This is going to be a little kind of a short, almost like a foundation for some of these other ones that are going to be coming up. kind of why we talk about what we do is because we do want you guys to have these conversations with Muslims, to get in deeper, to not just assume the things about them, because I think people are a lot more complex than that. And I think it does honor to the Lord whenever we treat other people as human beings, you know, because I think what I love about Jesus, whenever you see him in the Gospels, is that he really touches people, you know, according to their need, and he looks at them and he talks to them. And, you know, the thing that stands out to me is when Jesus is coming down from the Mount of, you know, when he did the Sermon on the Mount, there was a leper who comes in the midst of them. Of course, he's unclean. He's supposed to be shouting unclean, but he comes in the midst. And I know that the people that are following him are all gasping, right? He falls to his knees in front of Jesus and he says, you know, if you're willing, I know you can heal me. And Jesus, you know, says this amazing thing. He says, I am, and he touches the guy. He doesn't have to touch the guy, you know? That's not one of those things that's required. He's healed people from afar, you know? People have touched his clothes and healed. He's, you know, he's commanded people to be healed without touching him. But he touches this guy, this leper, this unclean skin disease. Everyone is gasping, and he makes the guy clean. It's crazy. And so when I think about, you know, us interacting with Muslims, it's like us engaging, and we don't have to touch the people. We don't have to get involved, you know, like we could just kind of be aloof, but, you know, I don't think that's what Christ, you know, calls us to be or to do. And so we get engaged in people's lives and meet and touch and talk. And I think that's, you know, kind of what we want to do, you know, as for the Zwemer Center and for Truth About Muslims, we want to have people engage in real life people. Not just to sit there academically and sit in their ivory towers and such. So, but yeah, so this is maybe like a little foretaste of what we're going to be doing in the future. As we talk about more details, it's always on this backdrop of relationship. We want people to have relationship with Muslims.
And I think in the next show, we have to probably talk about the barrel making that's happening when Islam comes into being.
Mm.
It's important to understand what's going on in the Byzantine Empire, what's going on in the Persian Empire,
right,
when Islam comes on the scene. In the same way that it's important to understand what's happening with the Greek world and the Roman world when Christianity comes on the scene. You miss huge parts of scripture if you don't understand what's going on politically, even sociologically, like things that Jesus will say will go right over your head. But if you understand that broader context, man, the scriptures come alive and it's amazing.
And it gives you... I think compassion for people, you know, because then all of a sudden their behavior doesn't seem just so erratic, you know, you really have compassion. So anyway, thank you guys so much for listening. As always, we want to thank everyone that just listens, that you guys, you know, continue to download. We want a broader audience, not, you know, for our sake. We don't really gain much. I mean, maybe in the heavens, you know, like
we're still working on sponsors. It's been like a year now, no sponsors.
But we're excited because this has been an entire year. We've never skipped a week. That's huge, you know, because when Trevor first told me the idea, I was like, I don't know if we can keep this up, but it's actually been really awesome and fun. And so thank you guys so much for listening. Keep writing reviews on iTunes. We got so many already, and it's so cool because it just continues to push us up and make us more visible to others that are searching for stuff like this. So
I think we are trying to change the public narrative here in America, and you guys are a part of that.
Right. And go to ZwemerCenter.com and read those articles. Post those articles on your Facebook, on your social media, on your Twitter. It gets word out there. People listen to our podcast that way, too. And of course, get, you know, other people to subscribe. There was this one guy who was telling us about his grandmother. Trevor, tell us that story really quick.
Which one was it?
Well, his grandmother, you know, was like
anti-Muslim. She was very much the Muslims are terrible. They're coming and we have to, you know, protect ourselves and stop the Muslims. And she started listening to the podcast, and the guy said now his grandma's like, you know, chomping at the bit to go to the mosque and share the love of Jesus with
people.
She just wants to hang out with Muslims and be Christ to them. And I was like, whoa there, grandma.
Yeah. That's such a cool story.
So if you were the grandma listening, we are so encouraged by your story.
Right.
We
love you, and we're so happy. And so with that, you know, just keep writing, you know, reviews and spreading it out, sending it to other people. And even if they don't like us, it's okay.
Yeah, it's, you know, okay.
That's not our...
It hurts just a little bit, but it's okay. I say we end it with a little bit from Cobble Dreams.
Yeah, we'll play that. And then, so we'll see you next week.
کنه شرق و یه چشم شده زمین تا آسمان.